Hello, and thanks for listening to Political Heat. I'm your host, Amy Mount. In this episode, we're moving from understanding voters to understanding a different kind of power in UK politics. Oil has influenced government policy since the early years of the 20th century, when Winston Churchill, at that time First Lord of the Admiralty, ordered that it should replace coal in fueling the Navy. From then on, oil shaped imperial and foreign policy towards the Middle East, which is of course still a major site of extraction today. And when commercial oil production began in the North Sea in the 1970s, it got more of a foothold in domestic politics too. The implications of climate change and the role of fossil fuels in driving it have since become ever more obvious. And it's fair to say the oil industry's response has not been 100% constructive. With me to examine this powerful vested interest today is Tessa Khan. Tessa is a formidable campaigner who I imagine makes oil executives rather nervous. She founded an organisation called Uplift in 2021, which supports a rapid and just transition away from oil and gas production in the UK. And throughout her career, Tessa has supported grassroots, regional and international movements for justice. She co-founded the Climate Litigation Network, and she has served as an expert advisor to UN human rights bodies and national governments. Tessa, welcome to Political Heat.
Thanks so much, Amy. Delighted to be here.
So what drew you to the oil and gas sector as a campaigner? Did you have a light bulb moment, or has it always been an area of interest for you?
I think there was a moment. I'm not sure I'd describe it as a light bulb moment, but certainly I think in 2020, as COVID hit, almost overnight, the oil price crashed and it went negative for a brief period of time. And suddenly people were talking about the beginning of the end for oil demand globally. And the date of peak oil was being brought forward in various forecasts. And, you know, I think it really ignited a conversation around how quickly that transition might happen. I think also, as someone who works on climate change, I've always been acutely aware of the power of the oil and gas industry and the fossil fuel industry more broadly in shaping climate politics. And it sort of had felt by about 2020, like in certainly in, you know, the UK and across much of Europe, and I think, you know, it's fair to say in the US as well, that the fight against coal was incredibly well developed. There was a powerful international norm that had emerged around the need to phase out coal. The UK government actually was one of the leading proponents of that in establishing the Powering Past Coal Alliance. Anyway, it sort of felt like we were winning the fight against coal. But on the oil and gas front, it certainly didn't feel like that. And it really feels like that is, in many ways, the next frontier of the energy transition. And when we're thinking about incumbency and incumbent political power, that's what we've got to start turning our attention to.
Yeah, and we'll come to the climate debate shortly. But first of all, I wanted to just look at the big picture of the oil industry. And I mentioned its long history of influence on our politics in my introduction. Are there any moments you would point to as being especially significant in that history?
Well, I think, you know, as you said, during the major wars in the 20th century, oil emerged as an incredibly important strategic asset. And so access to oil supply became a really preeminent UK government priority in wartime. And that's part of what led to, I mean, not just the sort of growing power of British oil and gas companies like BP, which went through a number of different iterations. The UK government has been a majority shareholder of BP at different times. You know, it also required BP and Shell and another oil and gas company during the Second World War to effectively, you know, basically took them under public ownership and commandeered their assets in service of what was needed for the British war effort. But there's always been, I think, a real understanding on the part of the British state of how strategically vital oil is. And then after North Sea oil and gas was discovered in the mid to late 60s, that just led to the creation pretty rapidly of a very significant domestic industry, both in terms of the numbers of people employed, all of the indirect jobs that created, the tax revenue that also brought into the country, the investment it created. But really, it in that sense was established in a very physical sense in the UK as well. And I think that, you know, we can also talk about all of the other ways that perhaps less visibly the oil and gas industry is influencing the British state, but they've always been, I think, very closely connected.
Yes. And we're mostly with this podcast looking at UK politics, but that is a really important reminder that there are UK entities, these companies which are now private, but at various times have had different degrees of state involvement, that have been British but have played huge roles globally in the development of this industry. And so the international footprint of UK politics and UK political economy around corporations is really substantial too.
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, we can, even though it may not be the British state that's a majority shareholder in these companies, a company like Shell, for example, is now headquartered in the UK, you know, and that's a decision that it made relatively recently. But that's also the case for a number of other pretty significant oil and gas companies and projects.
And why is that?
Well, I think, you know, there are all sorts of different advantages, corporate advantages, tax advantages, etc., that companies are looking for when they decide where to register. But yeah, it really speaks to the outsized footprint, as you say, that the UK has in terms of the global oil and gas market.
And you wouldn't probably, I imagine, describe the UK as a petrostate because oil isn't the primary driver of economic growth and jobs and so on. But are there any similarities between the UK and other oil producing countries in terms of our politics in particular?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, the UK, yeah, certainly it probably doesn't fall into the category of a petrostate, but probably the most interesting way in which it bears a resemblance to other oil and gas producing countries is the role that the industry ends up playing in our politics. And there is some very interesting scholarship that validates the idea that countries that have domestic fossil fuel production end up experiencing capture by the fossil fuel industry on both sides of politics.
And what do you mean by capture?
Just that both sides of politics are incentivized, influenced to go slow on climate policy in particular is the perspective of some of this scholarship. Because on the one hand, you have trade unions that are influenced by fossil fuel companies. And on the right, you also have business associations influencing politics that represent those interests as well.
This has been a really helpful overview. Thank you. And I think we will come back to some of those themes that you've drawn up in that perhaps later in this conversation. But let's focus now on the climate politics. Could you summarise, because there's probably quite a lot to say, what role the oil industry has played in our climate politics so far?
Sure. There's a very well documented influence that the oil and gas industry has had on slowing down ambition on climate policy. And you can look to the work of organisations like Influence Map, who have really tallied up kind of dollar for dollar, pound for pound, how much the oil and gas industry has spent since the Paris Agreement on lobbying against policies and investments that would basically get us closer to meeting those targets. So I think
the Paris Agreement on climate change that kind of committed the world to trying to get as close to 1.5 degrees, well below 2 degrees warming as possible.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, this might be a good point to say that the business plans of the oil and gas industry are fundamentally at odds with what the Paris Agreement and meeting that 1.5 degree target requires, in that we now know, and there is, you know, plenty of different modelling and different research that's contributed to this conclusion, but that, you know, basically, according to the International Energy Agency, in a pathway where we stay below 1.5 degrees of warming, there isn't room for new investment in oil and gas production. So, you know, as of a few years ago, basically, that was sort of the limit. And there are lots of different ways of of paraphrasing that, you know, whether it's people talk about needing to keep a significant percentage of existing oil and gas reserves in the ground if we're going to stay within that 1.5 degree target. That means we certainly can't add to those reserves. You know, what we have already is unburnable in part. Or you have the UN Environment Programme publishing now an annual production gap report, which sets out whether or not production plans by national governments of fossil fuels are compatible with the 1.5 degree target and the Paris Agreement targets. And at the moment, they're saying that production plans of fossil fuels of governments by 2030 would basically lead us to producing 110% more oil, gas and coal than we can burn if we're going to stay within those limits. So basically what's very clear is that the oil and gas industry needs to start shrinking and start shrinking quite rapidly if we're going to stay within those limits. So that's why it's expended quite a lot of money and energy on lobbying against the implementation of those targets and the policies that are needed. But I think there are slightly more insidious ways in which the oil and gas industry influences our politics. And I'd say really that's in three different ways. The first is there is a kind of startling revolving door between the oil and gas industry and the British establishment. And this is really well documented in a book called Crude Britannia. You know, it really gives so many examples of that revolving door. So, you know, of all of the ways in which basically people at the top of the oil and gas industry in the UK end up in British politics. And, you know, just to give a couple of examples of that. So Angie Hunter, who was Tony Blair's right-hand woman in the early days of the Labour government in 1997, her first job after leaving Downing Street was to be the PA for the CEO of BP. The current head of external affairs for Equinor, a Norwegian oil company that has significant interests in the UK, used to be the UK's ambassador to Sweden and spent years in the Foreign Service. So, you know, you can imagine the list of contacts and the access that that revolving door enables. So that's one thing. I think the second thing is, of course, just the level of access that the oil and gas industry has to politicians. I mean, the headquarters of Shell, BP and the industry lobby, Offshore Energies UK, are a short stroll from Downing Street and the Houses of Parliament, and we know that they are often in conversation and have the ears of politicians. And then finally, there's also evidence of the financial ties between MPs and peers and the oil and gas industry, and the fact that some MPs also continue to have second jobs that are connected to the oil and gas industry. So Nadeem Zahawi, the ex-chancellor, made a bit of money working for an oil and gas company while he was in Parliament. And yeah, we know that there are dozens of peers who have significant shareholdings in the sector. And that also extends, I think, crucially to the body that is currently the oil and gas industry regulator, the North Sea Transition Authority. So a number of board members and people within the senior management team have significant financial shareholdings in the oil and gas industry, which you would think pose a bit of a conflict of interest in the execution of their mandate. So it's a multi-tentacled kind of operation that is, yeah, really the way that the industry continues to influence politics.
So you've painted a picture there of deep relationships between the industry and government and regulators. Are there other tactics beyond just being in touch and maybe going to the same clubs and that sort of thing that the industry has deployed to disrupt climate progress or slow down the kinds of regulations that might do what the IEA and other agencies are advising, which is leave more oil and gas in the ground?
Yeah, I mean, most fundamentally, we know that the industry has deliberately obfuscated the science of climate change, you know, and that conclusion is the result of, you know, really deep investigative work that NGOs around the world have done, looking into the research findings in the 1970s of companies like Shell and Exxon. You know, in so many ways, their understanding of the climate science was more sophisticated than any other organization or agency in the world. And they deliberately suppressed those findings publicly. They obviously made a decision to continue to peddle a product and profit from a product that they understood was contributing to inexorably to the climate crisis. And there's also evidence that those companies and the industry associations that represent them have funded think tanks that also continue to sow doubt in the public discourse around climate change, and that has led to the denial that we see, you know, the delay that we see in the implementation of climate measures. So yeah, certainly there's been work that's been done that I think is much more malign in that regard than just traditional lobbying.
Yeah, and we saw in the heard in the first episode of Political Heat, where I was talking with Rachel Wolf, who's a polling expert, that there is now in the UK really broad public concern about climate change. But I think it's fair to say, I mean, the data bears this out, that has risen over time. And so there were years where this issue was not fully understood by the public. There was not this sense of, oh, this is something that really matters to me. I'm worried about my children, my grandchildren, and so on. And I think, you know, decades really have been lost where we could have been making progress, and we're only now really starting to grapple with what's necessary, partly, as you say, because the people who knew what was going on were not sharing that, we're not acting on it in an honourable way.
Exactly.
I want to come on to some more recent policy debates that we've seen here in the UK. Energy security and cost are two major issues that have both risen up the government's agenda, particularly since Russia invaded Ukraine. And in the previous episode of Political Heat, Rachel was explaining that these have become salient issues in terms of how the British public thinks about climate action as well. So people tend to see net zero policies as a way actually to manage future energy price spikes.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to look at how these issues of security and cost have played out in a couple of recent policy debates. So firstly, about the windfall tax on oil and gas, and secondly, about the licensing of new oil and gas projects in the North Sea. So on that first one, your organisation Uplift was one of those that was successfully campaigning for a windfall tax on oil and gas after energy prices spiked really dramatically in mm-hmm. 2021. I wondered if you had any reflections on what you learnt during that time.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I think one of the preconditions for that sort of successful campaigning that I think was laid in 2021 was an increasing understanding, thanks to a court case that was basically made its way through the courts in 2021 that was challenging the way that the tax regime operates to effectively subsidise the oil and gas industry. I think that contributed to an initial understanding by sort of the end of 2021 that actually oil and gas companies benefit from really generous tax breaks that other industries and other sectors don't in the UK. And that's actually led to the industry as a whole paying negative tax in recent years on a couple of occasions. Negative tax just means that we give them more in tax rebates than they pay into the exchequer.
Just to pause there, I mean, why has that happened? How did we get to that situation?
Through some pretty effective lobbying, basically, on the part of the industry and its representatives in the accounting world. But basically, around 2015, the oil and gas tax regime was redesigned so that you can claim as an oil and gas industry 40% of the costs that you spend on decommissioning oil and gas infrastructure. So that just means cleaning up your operations once they're finished, right? Like dismantling rigs and pipelines and so on. 40% of those costs end up being borne by the taxpayer. So you're entitled to rebates for a huge chunk of costs.
Wow.
I think, you know, it's maybe worth putting a pin in that, you know, how you square that with the polluter pays principle and with the treatment that other sectors get in the UK is, I think, something that's unresolved. But anyway, that's basically what came about. And as a result, it's meant that, you know, the oil and gas industry often talks about the fact that its overall headline tax rate is higher than most other sectors in the UK. So this is pre-windfall tax, at 40% of is their sort of headline tax rate. But it's not really relevant in our view to compare how much the oil and gas industry pays compared to other sectors, because the oil and gas industry just isn't like other sectors. They are extracting a national non-renewable resource. So what we should be comparing them to is how much other oil and gas sectors are taxed in other countries. Mm-hmm. And when you look at it from that lens, the UK has offered some of the lowest tax rates in the world for any oil and gas sector, and to the point that according to Rystad Energy, which is an independent energy consultancy, oil and gas projects in the North Sea were the most profitable large offshore projects in the world, you know, compared to any other country. And that's not because the North Sea geologically is at this point particularly productive. It's entirely down to the fiscal regime. So we kind of came into 2022 and Russia's invasion of Ukraine, the massive spike in gas prices that caused the commensurate huge increase in oil and gas industry profits, with an understanding that the oil and gas industry had been benefiting from an incredibly generous tax regime. And so that made it, I think, even easier to make the case that aside from the fact that the profits that they were making were true windfall profits, you know, they really didn't expend a penny more than they would under normal circumstances. They just happened to be in a place and in a time that meant that because of a war, their product, you know, there was the squeeze on supply for their product, which meant that they could charge more for it, and they did. And I think the kind of morality of that, the stark morality of that, mm-hmm. plus the fact that, you know, we already had in recent years, in 2016, 2017, an industry that had paid negative tax, I think really laid the foundation for a pretty effective and, I think, you know, irrefutable call to impose a windfall tax.
And despite that moral argument for taxing or, you know, raising the tax on the industry, it wasn't necessarily seen in those moral terms by decision makers and, mm-hmm. and perhaps by the wider set of influencing people around them. Why do you think that was?
Well, I think the oil and gas industry, actually, before the calls for the windfall tax happened, I think they were incredibly opportunistic and successful in positioning themselves as, you know, the oil and gas industry in the UK and in other countries as suddenly being a strategically really important industry that the government should support, because we want, in circumstances like this, to encourage more domestic production or production in countries that are good countries compared to countries like Russia. So, you know, I think they initially had a lot of success with the narrative that actually this was a moment to really be getting behind our domestic oil and gas industries and to make sure that we had secure energy supplies and energy independence. And I think that that rhetoric really landed initially and was quite persuasive. But I think the more those arguments were publicly interrogated, you know, thanks to the work of lots of campaigners, to really start to question whether or not the UK oil and gas industry is contributing to energy security. Certainly, you know, is it contributing to more affordable energy, given affordability is the real question at that time. You know, I think once those sorts of conversations started to happen, that rhetoric started to fall apart a bit.
Okay, so the oil industry, faced with some challenges around the huge profits that it was making as a result of the war in Ukraine, tried to pivot the debate around to a conversation about British energy security, energy independence. But then that itself led to different kinds of critique of the industry, that actually you're not really contributing to our energy independence. Could you just explain in a bit more detail why that is? Because I think this is one of the nubs of the arguments that still gets, yeah, that the industry is still pushing forward today. Like, why doesn't the fact that we have oil drills, oil rigs in the North Sea make us more secure?
Yeah, certainly. So I think there are a few different ways to address the argument. The first is that we don't own, as in the UK state doesn't own, our oil and gas resources. It licenses the areas in the North Sea that oil and gas companies can drill in, but once they have the product, it belongs to those companies, and they sell that product to basically whoever will pay the highest price for it. So 80% of the oil that is produced in the UK, according to the government's own figures, ends up being exported. So in that regard, you can see straight away the kind of connection between domestic production and domestic energy security starting to break down. That figure is less for gas, but even with gas, which tends to, you know, it's easier to pipe kind of directly into people's homes, we still export a significant chunk of our gas. And really, I think what politicians have started to grapple with is that there is no way we can oblige privately owned companies to put UK energy security and the public interest first. They will ultimately sell their product wherever it's most profitable. And that is why we've ended up exporting huge quantities of what we end up producing at home. The second thing to say is that, you know, the real crisis that Russia's invasion of Ukraine caused in terms of energy security, it was around the price that we were then required to pay for gas. And that's what pushed gas availability out of what was possible for millions of households across the UK. It's what made people, you know, it's what led to a really serious social crisis in terms of fuel poverty in this country that we've seen actually again this winter, with millions of people being in debt to their energy suppliers and unable to afford their energy bills. It's not that we don't have supply, it's that we don't have affordable supply. And no matter how much oil and gas we produce in the UK, given the amount that we can produce, it doesn't make a difference to the price that we pay for it, again, because it's an internationally traded product and those prices are set on international markets. So whether it's gas coming into my home that is drilled from the North Sea or in Norway or comes in on a tanker from the US or Qatar, you know, we don't end up setting the price that we pay for it. So that's, I think, the other really important aspect of this.
Yeah, and one of the images that I think demonstrates what you've been saying in my mind is that of oil tankers in the middle of the ocean turning round to get to where the price is highest for their product, which is an incredible thought when you think that one of the main metaphors of something that is difficult to turn around is an oil tanker. It does just show how irrelevant really the UK market is to the oil and gas that's being extracted right there in the North Sea, even though it's just off our coast.
Yeah. And then I think, you know, while we're kind of on the arguments, I think that the government and the industry have mounted in recent months in defence of new oil and gas licensing and more production here. The other thing that we often hear is, you know, that it's cleaner than what we would end up importing. Mm-hmm. And again, you know, the premise of that is worth really questioning, because when we're talking about the cleanliness of different kinds of oil and gas that we import, that never accounts from the emissions from burning that oil and gas, which is where the vast majority of emissions come from. As soon as you factor that in, the difference that it makes is marginal, whether or not it's piped in from Norway or it comes into the UK from the North Sea. So leaving that aside, which I think really makes that debate pretty disingenuous, and we should probably keep that in mind whenever we hear it, UK oil and gas production just isn't that clean. It's actually in the bottom half of the global league table, again, according to independent energy analysts like Rystad, in terms of the cleanliness of our upstream production. So that's to say, you know, how much carbon we emit in the course of carbon or methane we emit in the course of pulling it out of the ground. If you compare that to operations in other countries, the UK still uses practices that have been outdated for decades in places like Norway that mean that we just have more polluting oil and gas than many other countries that we import do, certainly Norway, which is our, you know, biggest importing partner in terms of gas.
Okay, so there were all these arguments that the oil industry was trying to put forward to say, please don't tax us anymore, despite the fact that we're making record profits. And in fact, despite the influence that it does have, which you've outlined compellingly earlier on in this conversation, a windfall tax was put in place. What does that success tell you about future campaigning on this issue?
Well, I think it goes to show you that the social license of the oil and gas industry isn't what it used to be. You know, I think that for the picture that I've painted of how politically well-resourced the industry is, I actually think that in many ways the oil and gas industry is more vulnerable in terms of, you know, its social license, the level of support it has both publicly and politically, than it ever has been. And I think that's why we see constantly the industry repositioning itself, trying out new arguments, trying to find new ways of persuading us that it is a crucial partner in the energy transition. I don't think that that's a tenable position. And I think that, you know, each of those arguments is falling away. And the fact that a Conservative government introduced, not only introduced, but twice strengthened a windfall tax on the industry is evidence of that.
And let's come then to the other debate, which is actually still ongoing. We're recording this in mid-March 2024, and the Offshore Petroleum Licensing Bill is making its way through the House of Lords. Could you tell me what's the government aiming to do with that bill, and where do the other parties stand on it? Because that's one where there's much more controversy about what's the right thing to do than there was with the windfall tax, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I actually think that this bill is so transparently an electoral ploy on the part of the government, in that it doesn't achieve anything substantive in its, mm-hmm. you know, on its own terms. So at its heart, it's basically saying that the body in charge of oil and gas licensing, the North Sea Transition Authority, will now hold annual oil and gas licensing rounds. That is the objective of this bill. And the oil and gas authority, the North Sea Transition Authority, has been holding effectively annual licensing rounds for years. I mean, it has that within its power as it stands. And actually, there are board minutes from the NSTA where they say, we don't really think we need this additional power. It's already well within our remit to have annual licensing rounds if we want to. So it feels pretty transparently like a way to put the Labor Party or opponents, political opponents, in a position where they have to oppose it and then defend that position. But I think it hasn't gone exactly according to plan for the government, insofar as it led to the resignation of Chris Skidmore and then a by-election, which the government lost. And there have also been other pretty high-profile Conservative critics of the bill, people like Alok Sharma, for example, who have proposed amendments and abstained from votes on the bill. So, you know, I think predictably the Labor Party has voted against it. It will pass because of the majority that the government has. But I really don't think that anyone sees it as making any material difference to oil and gas production in the UK. It really does just feel like a bit of a stunt.
So it's not going to have an impact on our energy security. Is it going to have an impact on our emissions?
No, in short. Okay. You know, as I said, the oil and gas licensing body, the NSTA, can already have licensing rounds as frequently as it likes. They've been close to annual in recent years. So it's hard to see how this would make a material difference to overall production.
And despite the fact that this bill is probably going to have negligible impact on the real world, I think, as you say, it has put the Labour Party in particular in a more tricky position because of some of its key stakeholders. So there has been some pushback from the major energy unions, hasn't there? I mean, they're worried about what will happen to workers on and around the oil rigs. Regardless of how impactful the bill itself will be, do you think the unions are right to be concerned about the overall direction of travel for the North Sea and the declining oil and gas production there?
Yeah, I mean, I think that sort of dialogue with the unions, I think, has been happening ever since the Labor Party announced that it would end new oil and gas licensing in government. And I think that that's inevitable. It's inevitable that, you know, and I think it's necessary that there is a conversation in which the Labor Party, if it's in government, or any government that decides that it wants to end the expansion of oil and gas production in the UK and ultimately wind the industry down, there needs to be a proper transition plan in place to support oil and gas workers, but as well as the communities that have been where a lot of that investment, where a lot of the indirect jobs and the supply chains have ended up located, you know, what their future looks like. So I really welcome more debate about that, because I think what we've actually seen happening in the UK for the last decade is effectively a decline in the industry, but one that has been completely unplanned. So, you know, the North Sea is a mature basin. Mm-hmm. Peak production happened about 20 years ago. So the industry has been producing less and less. That's meant that in the last decade, in which, by the way, you know, under a Conservative government, we've had hundreds of new oil and gas licenses issued, oil and gas industry jobs have halved in that period. So that includes direct and indirect employment, but we think about 200,000 jobs have been lost in the last decade. And a city like Aberdeen, which is really at the heart of the oil and gas sector, has seen on multiple metrics a huge decline in terms of social and economic outcomes, even despite the fact that it is considered the UK's oil capital. But there's been an increase in fuel poverty, in the use of food banks. Overall average incomes have declined. You know, this transition is happening already. And what we really need from the next government is a clear plan to manage that transition. And I think that's probably what trade unions are getting at. And the fact is that what we have in place at the moment, there is actually a North Sea transition deal, which is an agreement that was brokered between the UK government and the oil and gas industry in 2021, which acknowledges that, you know, if we are going to meet our climate targets, it's inevitable that the industry is going to have to transition. And it sets, you know, it sort of addresses a range of issues, including setting sort of decarbonisation targets for the industry. It has some stuff in it around skills, for example. But ultimately, it is, first of all, an agreement that excluded trade unions and the Scottish government from the development of that agreement. So arguably, two of the most important stakeholders weren't in the room. It's a non-binding agreement. And ultimately, it continues to basically put the industry in the driving seat. And what we've seen is an industry that has made record profits in the last couple of years, and that's coincided with record low levels of investment in the North Sea, not just in renewable energy, which three quarters of North Sea oil and gas producers don't invest in at all, renewable energy production. So, you know, that I think is indicative of their role in the energy transition. They haven't even been investing in more oil and gas production in the North Sea. Most of their profits have been going to shareholders and paying off debt and so on. So this really isn't an industry, in short, that we think on its own can be trusted to drive an equitable transition that looks after people, that makes sure that, you know, these communities and work, that the workforce has a future, especially given that there are so many pathways in which you could imagine the UK oil and gas workforce being retrained to support the other industries that we know will be absolutely crucial to the UK's economic future. So, you know, we share, I think, a concern that at the moment there is no real plan for the transition.
And what would a real plan entail, do you think? I mean, you've mentioned retraining and reskilling for industries that do have a future. Are there other components you would like to see in that kind of plan?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I think that the most important dimension is process and who's in the room and who's sort of driving the conversation. So as I said, at the moment, it's industry-led, and what we need to make sure is that trade unions and local communities and local authorities in Scotland in particular are the ones who are shaping what the transition looks like. So process, I think, is key when we're talking about just transition. Second, yes, there's a whole set of support, I think, that's needed for the workforce. That includes, yeah, as we've said, making it easier to retrain, to move into other industries. I mean, at the moment, you have this absurd situation where basically if you're someone who dives off an oil and gas rig, you have to pay £25,000 to recertify to dive off an offshore wind platform. You know, it's the same
right.
skill, but the certification, the training bodies don't recognise each other's qualifications. So things like that could be made much easier through what some organisations are calling an offshore skills passport. So organisations like Platform and Friends of the Earth Scotland have really been at the forefront with unions of advocating for this. We also just need a guarantee of better jobs in renewables. I think, you know, there is definitely truth in the fact that at the moment the pay and the conditions in the oil and gas sector are just better than what's being offered in offshore renewables. And that disparity needs to be addressed. Those need to be unionised jobs, you know, good quality jobs, and they don't exist in a consistent way at the moment. I think the third thing is really about ensuring community and local ownership of the transition. So beyond, as I said, sort of embedding local authorities in transition planning, ideally, you know, we'd want the wealth created by the alternative energy industries of the future to stay in communities. At the moment, you know, foreign companies own significant chunks of our renewable energy industry. A lot of that wealth, the supply chains are elsewhere. We should really be thinking about ways to bring that manufacturing capacity and bring that wealth back into the communities in the UK that need it and that will be at the pointier end of the transition away from oil and gas.
So we've talked about the situation facing people who are, you know, diving off oil rigs, working in the oil industry at the kind of employee end of the system. I just wondered, at the executive end, what would you do right now if you were in the shoes of an oil industry executive who, you know, has pressure from their shareholders to keep maximizing profits, who has been trained in a certain skill set, understands a certain world? What would you do if you were in that position?
I mean, I think there's a version of that that would not be at all compatible with the real world. So, you know, I think there's a world in which I would probably wind the company up, pay the profits out in reparations to communities that are suffering from the impacts of climate change. I think, you know, there's a moral argument that that's the kind of thing that we should be looking to the oil and gas industry to do. I think if I was looking to preserve my business as an oil and gas executive, if, you know, that was my responsibility. There are examples, there aren't many, but, you know, there's at least one example of an oil and gas company, the Danish oil and gas company, transitioning entirely into a renewable energy company. You know, it is possible. Mm-hmm. And as we've discussed, a lot of these companies do have an understanding of the energy system skills in-house that are useful for the transition. And I think it just requires real leadership to reorient your mission such that that's the future. And it's not simply, you know, what I think the oil and gas industry is doing right now, which is, as I said, you know, basically trying to live the high life for as long as possible before they hit a pretty abrupt end, you know, by paying out massive dividends and ignoring, in some ways, the inevitability of the decline of the industry. I think it's an industry that is about to meet pretty imminently a significant decrease in demand for its products. And then inevitably it will have to think about the question of what it does next. So you might as well get ahead of that. Try and be one of the companies that takes more of the market share in the renewable energy sector rather than be one of the last oil and gas companies to be standing, which is what every oil and gas company thinks it's going to be the last oil and gas company standing.
But they do have choices.
Exactly.
Great. We will have to leave it there. Tessa, thank you so much for joining Political Heat.
Thanks so much, Amy. It's been a pleasure.
So, a couple of thoughts from me before we wrap up the second episode of Political Heat. I wanted to talk with Tessa Khan because her campaigning with Uplift is confronting such a daunting part of the fossil fuel economy, one that outwardly looks entrenched with its vast profits, slick marketing, and the ear of government and of regulators. But I think this conversation has shown, more perhaps than I imagined it would, that appearances can be deceptive. The recent battles over the windfall tax and energy security indicate that power is slipping away from the oil industry. It is starting to lose the argument. That's not inevitable, it's testament to the tireless work of campaigners such as Tessa. My second point is that, as with all transitions of power, it really matters how that happens. We've heard how the British state played a crucial role in the industry's beginnings and continues to shape its operating context today. It surely needs to be active in enabling a sustainable future for the oil and gas workforce and for the wider communities it has come to underpin. That's it for this week. If you're enjoying this podcast, please rate, review, and subscribe. I'd also love to hear any feedback or suggestions, and you can send an email to politicalheatpod@gmail.com or find me on Twitter at politicalheat24. In the next episode, I'll be talking with Professor Becky Willis about whether the problem facing climate action is too much democracy or too little. As part of that conversation, we'll be examining what politicians think their job is in relation to the climate. Political Heat was produced and presented by me, Amy Mount. It was edited by Sarah Eldridge. Thanks for listening.